Welcome, Near Enemy listeners, to episode 23. I'm Matt Sittman, one of the podcast co-hosts, and I'm here with my friend Sam Adler-Bell.
Hey, Matt.
Yes, can we say anything to help our listeners distinguish us?
I was about to say, it's come up again that people can't tell the difference between our voices. Somebody said that my voice is the more dour and sardonic voice, and yours is often, at least on the surface, more sunny and optimistic. And I have to say that's a not terrible mnemonic for distinguishing between the voices.
Yes. I like that you threw in on the surface, because it is true. It's all an act.
Well, yeah, because
I'm probably more, well, it's hard to say who's more pessimistic and depressive and dour, me or you, but it's close.
You do a better job of leaving it out the door, you know? We have a conversation about how we're both depressed, and then we hit record, and you go, hey, listeners, how are you? It's another episode of Know Your Enemy.
Yeah, it's almost disturbing how I change on a dime like that. Well, we're really excited about this conversation we're about to share with you, because it's with our good friend Dorothy Fortenberry.
Yeah.
It was one we'd been hoping to have for a long time, and Dorothy's just someone we knew basically when we started the podcast that we wanted to have her on. And she's, for those who don't know her, she's a playwright and screenwriter. She's probably best known right now. She's one of the writers and a producer on The Handmaid's Tale, a show some of you might have heard of. It's been in the news lately.
Has some relevance to contemporary American politics.
Yes. And we don't want to give too much away, but Dorothy is just a political thinker that I find incredibly sharp and brilliant. And so it's a wide-ranging conversation. And we talk a lot about kind of women in politics. We talk a lot about Amy Coney Barrett. We talk about Dorothy's background and kind of her unique outlook, what shaped it and what it kind of consists of. So we don't need to preview it much more than that, I think. But it was really lovely that she came on and I had so much fun talking to her. I was disappointed when it was over.
Yeah, me too. And we joke in the episode that we're treating Dorothy as a one-woman focus group for suburban wine moms, which she very gamely plays along with. But I think if you want to orient yourself in some way, one of the useful things about talking to Dorothy is that she's a brilliant thinker and also, you know, has been thinking a lot about, in this moment, how the right and the left are trying to appeal to, quote-unquote, suburban women, suburban moms.
Right. Uh-huh.
And she has a set of experiences that inform, you know, kind of her idiosyncratic take on those questions.
So, yeah, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We really had fun doing it. And we should probably do some housekeeping before we turn it over to Dorothy.
Yeah.
Well, as always, we're grateful Dissent sponsors this podcast. And if you subscribe on Patreon for $10 a month or more, you get a free digital subscription to Dissent. We're doing lots of bonus episodes. So even if you sign up for $5 a month, you get a lot of stuff from us that other people don't get. And I know for sure we'll be doing some kind of election special, maybe, you know, in the next few days, record it and get it out before the election. So keep that in mind.
Yeah. If you want to hear that, sign up on Patreon. It's patreon.com/knowyourenemy. And you get to hear all our backlog of bonus episodes.
Right. And we wanted to shout out the artist behind the wonderful music we play during every episode.
Yes. We often get questions about the intro and outro music. The music for the podcast is done by our friend Will Epstein, who records under the name High Water. The songs that we use on the podcast are from a record of his called Crush, which you can get on Spotify and you can buy it on vinyl or however you like to listen to music. I need to remember to make sure to call out Will Epstein and his music every time we do an intro to the episode, because it's excellent and everybody loves it.
Well, is that everything, Sam?
I think that's it. Yeah. We, of course, love it when people rate and review the podcast on iTunes. We love it when you recommend us to your friends. And, you know, I hope that we can give you some comfort in these last few days before the election as you're, you know, curled up in a ball, rocking back and forth, waiting to see what the future holds.
All righty. Well, here's our conversation with Dorothy Fortenberry.
Enjoy.
Dorothy Fortenberry, welcome to Know Your Enemy.
Thank you so much for having me. It is great to be here.
Yeah. Well, I wish you were here. You're in California. And I'm in Manhattan and Sam is in Brooklyn. So it's a shame we all couldn't actually hang out together.
I know. It feels like this has been a long time coming.
I know. I was supposed to be in New York in September for a Commonweal event. And I still have it on my Google calendar because I can't quite cope with the reality that we're in. And I just look at it and I'm like, oh, that's a little nugget from another timeline.
Yes. And it's through Commonweal that I first met you. We did an event together out in Berkeley. What was it? Almost 2 years ago now, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
All the pre-pandemic times blur together. But in the years since, you've written for me a bunch of times at Commonweal, which has been really lovely for me. And so, and we'll reference some of that in this conversation. But I'm glad you're getting to talk to Sam, because sometimes I feel like on Twitter, you actually love Sam a little more than me.
I mean,
this is one of those answers you have to be very, very careful about.
Okay, so what I will say to you is what I say to my kids, which is that I have the same amount of love for both of you, but I express that love differently depending on the circumstance and the occasion.
Right.
But it is the same quantity, but it might not always come across in the same manifestation, because different circumstances require different forms of love. And that's why sometimes somebody gets something that somebody else doesn't get. So that is my mom of two kids answer to who's prettier, which is you're both the prettiest.
That's a very, very good and satisfying answer to me.
Yeah. And since you mentioned your two lovely daughters at home, we jokingly have said we're bringing you on the podcast to represent the wine mom community.
Yes, I'm very happy to be your local wine mom correspondent.
Well, to begin with, I hope you don't mind I am springing this on you, Dorothy, but you know, I've read a lot of your writing, even the work you haven't done for Commonweal. But one of my favorite pieces is the review of Andrea Dworkin's, the collection of hers that came out recently. It's titled One of Those Serious Women. But I wanted to read the opening paragraphs to it because I thought it captured something about you. And this is what you write. When I was 13, I decided it was time to be a feminist. In my family, this wasn't really something that needed to be announced, but nonetheless, I felt compelled to claim the label as my own. From this point on, I would be buying the manifestos about patriarchy with my allowance money. Thank you very much. My boyfriend, also of course a feminist, and at 14, a year more radical than I, told me that women shouldn't be ruled by men's oppressive beauty standards, which I interpreted as a directive to stop shaving my legs. Wanting to be both a good feminist and a good girlfriend, I complied. And then I wore knee socks for the better part of a year because I hated the way my shins looked, but I didn't want to disappoint him or the movement.
True story. True story.
So who are you, Dorothy Fortenberry? I thought that hesitation at the end said something about you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of those anecdotes that I lived through and then I kind of forgot about. And then recently I was thinking about it and I was like, wait a minute. I stopped shaving my legs because a boy told me to. That's like, what kind of feminist am I that I'm like, oh man, I really want to like shave my legs, but I really can't disappoint my boyfriend. So I gotta just keep these legs hairy. And then I had these maroon knee socks and I had navy knee socks and I would wear them and I looked ridiculous. But I really didn't want to walk around town with my hairy legs. I mean, I think, you know, the reason I began the essay that way is it does capture the fact that I have a pull towards a kind of radical politics. I've always been interested in politics. I've always been interested in gender politics, but I also have a pull towards being a very normal person. Mm-hmm. And I have a pull towards, you know, wearing skirts that you buy at the mall and looking like everybody else. And, you know, going on dates. And we all live in the systems that we live under. So, you know, the idea that a 13-year-old would take over seriously what her 14-year-old boyfriend says feels like not a shocking position to be in, right? That's not like a crazy scenario. And I think that's very much sort of the edge on which I've muddled my way through a lot of this is there's a pull towards like, ooh, I'm going to read the radical crazy thing. I'm going to try to find out about new and exciting things. And then there's a pull towards, you know, I'm just going to be a regular middle of the road lady.
Mm-hmm. And I saw in that quote too, the, we said you did this because your boyfriend told you to, you know, maybe we could say one of your other boyfriends is Jesus. And
oh my God, I was drinking tea when you said that. And I like almost spit tea out all over my computer.
Yes. But I was going to say that that the men who supposedly embody him on earth or represent him on earth also are complicated men in your lives. And I think we've bonded over sort of both of our struggles with the Catholic Church too.
Yeah, absolutely.
To say the least. As a woman, especially, I know you have thoughts.
Yeah, very much so. And I think also thoughts about, you know, how much do I follow these directives? How much am I putting directives on myself that I'm not necessarily getting? You know, where are these directives coming from? Do these directives have any bearing, you know, my 14-year-old boyfriend, for example, did not know what it was to go through the world as a woman with unshaved legs. So he was, you know, right, making a suggestion unrelated to his own experience and his own body about what someone else should do with their body, mm-hmm. which is not unlike our beloved church. So, yeah.
And it sort of gets the... you're a rebel who likes to follow the rules kind of person. that maybe contradiction or tension, but in the context of this conversation, and maybe we'll, you know, get to this as we go along, but you're someone who really cares about institutions, even if you're kind of banging the door of those institutions, yelling about what they're getting wrong.
Yeah. So we were watching The Incredibles 2 last night as a family on our Sunday movie night. And there's a part in The Incredibles 2 where Mrs. Incredible is fighting the bad guy. And at some point, the bad guy says to her, you know, if it weren't for your core beliefs, I think we could have been friends. And Mrs. Incredible says, at least I have core beliefs. And then, like, you know, kicks her through a window. And you can't find a gif of Mrs. Incredible saying, at least I have core beliefs, and then kicking the bad guy through the window on the internet, which is shocking.
That's patriarchy.
I was appalled because I was like, this is the only expression that I want of my sort of position vis-a-vis the world is Mrs. Incredible screaming, at least I have core beliefs. But it really spoke to me in that moment, as, you know, an aspiring superhero and mother of the idea that, yeah, there are things that we stand for. And I think that's why, you know, part of my love for institutions comes from a really strong belief that we as individuals are not so great and pretty weak and fallible. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we can make up for what institutions have done for us just sort of with by our own moxie, I'm incredibly skeptical of. So I don't, you know, I have a lot of critiques of every single institution that I'm a part of, mm-hmm. But I also have a deep love, respect, and faith in the idea of institutions.
Yeah.
Well, and I think also something that we share, that we might share, Dorothy, is an acknowledgement or keeping in our sights the fact that those institutions are themselves composed of people.
Absolutely.
Who have the capacity to shape them and change them.
Absolutely. And I think for me, you know, I gave a talk to a group of like young climate activists in Hollywood recently, and they're lovely and they're very sweet, and I felt very old. And one of the things I said to them is, I was like, you know, you can form all brand new things, but then you have to get all the stuff that goes with the things. Mm-hmm. If you can find a way to take over institutions that already exist and influence them, they have real estate, they have copy machines, mm-hmm. they have, yep. you know, all of the infrastructure, like they have a big room with folding chairs in it that no one is using. You can come into that room and then you don't have to find a place to get folding chairs. So I do feel like, yeah, institutions, if we abandon them completely, I feel like what we'll be left with is less than if we try to, you know, reform and remake.
We're really previewing all the specific topics of this conversation elusively in this introduction.
Yeah, because I was going to say one of those institutions you maybe have a love-hate relationship to is the Democratic Party, for example.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you mentioned giving a talk to climate activists out in Hollywood. Well, listeners who have already will have heard our introduction will know something about you. You write for The Handmaid's Tale. You're a playwright. You live out in California. But I think it took me a while to learn, knowing you, that you grew up in Washington, D.C., or right around Washington, D.C. So I wondered if you could sort of, I don't mean this to be too broad of a question, but talk about kind of how you grew up and the shaping of your political consciousness, if I can use such high-minded language, and a little bit more about where you're coming from politically.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the city of D.C., which is an important distinction for me. So actually within the city limits, inside the little diamond shape.
And not Chevy Chase.
Not Chevy Chase. Not McLean. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Actually within city limits. And, you know, growing up in D.C., I think politics is just everywhere. It's not something you have to go out and find. It's something that is, mm-hmm. you live it, you eat it, you breathe it. It's a company town. And then the neighborhood that I grew up in specifically was a very diverse neighborhood. It was at that time a very gay neighborhood. So just walking to the bus stop, I saw silence equals death posters. You know, walking to, you know, get groceries, you would see people having protests. You would see people wearing t-shirts with slogans that you would, you know, I had questions about. So I was just encountering a ton of political speech and political activism in my daily life, just kind of, you know, living and eating and sleeping and breathing. It was just there. So I think mm-hmm. that started very early. And I think it became the idea that it was something that we should pay attention to, that there were fights going on, and that the consequences of those fights mattered, was a really big deal to me, even as a kid. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I went to, for high school, I didn't go there for elementary school, but for high school, I went to Sidwell Friends, which is sort of the like or liberal educational institution. You know, it's where Chelsea Clinton went, it's right. where the Obama girls went. Like, it's, and it's very much the embodiment of a very particular worldview. I think going there, I absorbed what that worldview is, sort of the most mainstream Democrat lib, you know, mindset that you could get. But I also, just because of different forces in my life, I was also coming into contact with ideas that criticized that. So some of that was uh-huh. from quote unquote the left. You know, I ran the school's gay straight alliance with my best friend, and we were constantly, you know, trying to do, you know, queer activism politics within the context of a private school in the 90s. That wasn't like totally easy. Mm-hmm. You know, there were people who were pushing right. back on it. There were people who were making fun of it. You know, so I learned in the context of that, like, what politics looks like as a sort of day in, day out concern. So that was like, we have to make the brownies every week because we have to have the bake sale because we have to raise money because mm-hmm. we want to get a speaker to come to an assembly and say that it's okay to be gay. but that's uh-huh. like, it's a really basic commitment of like, if you don't make the brownies, then the whole thing falls apart, you know? Uh-huh. But it was also I think a bit of training in sort of how to move through high school, which is like, you know, a judgy, hard place, having mm-hmm. staked out a position with a certain politics to it. Like, when do you choose confrontation and when do you choose humor or warmth or, you know, some other form of self-presentation as a way to kind of sway people over to your side. So I feel like I also learned a lot about like, how do you communicate a message within a not necessarily super welcoming community, to make yourself seem fun and accessible.
Right.
That was basically what yeah. I did for 4 years was, you know, I would put up posters on National Coming Out Day that just said like, be a friend of Dorothy, and like sort of put myself up there as like, if anybody wants to come out, like I'll be great about it. I'm super nice. You know, that was sort of one form of politics that I think was, you know, on the edge of not even within yeah. that very normal democratic world, like that was not the Democratic Party platform, you know, at that time. Like that was, mm-hmm. right. you know, I was pushing beyond what sort of mainstream Democratic opinion was from the left. And then I feel like at home, You know, being raised Catholic, being raised by my particular family, I also was getting, a sort of acid critique of that world. Like my mom is an amazing mm-hmm. person, and she, you know, hates NPR, hates Volvos, hates, you know, the sort of mainstream East Coast liberal identity, like really gets on her nerves. And so there was a lot of grousing about that. I was in a world, but I was also very aware that I could critique that world from multiple angles and see sort of what that world was lacking. And, you know, and it was a world that was very concerned with individual success. It was a world that was very concerned with the sort of meritocratic achievement model. So, you know, I would go to my college counselor and they would say, here are these colleges you should look at. And then I would come home and my mom would have, you know, armed services. And she'd be like, have you thought about signing? You know, and it was like trolling. Mm. I mean, she was definitely trolling me, but she was trolling me to basically be like, you know, I went and got these brochures because the world is bigger than the world you're seeing. And like, I'm trolling you to sort of remind you that there are other ways of getting an education or of things you can do when you're 18. And I'm not letting you think this is the only thing on planet Earth.
We think about motherhood as trolling would be a great other episode for the podcast.
It's a very
kind thing, challenging and kind thing for a mother to do in certain circumstances.
Yeah, I mean the thing about my mom is I feel like she, if she were a pundit, she has like staked out these positions that at the time were totally radical, strange positions. And I feel like everyone has come over to her and she would have such pundit cred if she had like had a podcast in the 90s. She was, you know, like a Democrat, you know, feminist who was really mad at Bill Clinton, which was not a popular Democrat feminist position in the 90s. She had a lot of opinions about like urbanization and growth and, you know, was very pro-development and saw, you know, anti-apartment builders as racists. And she would like yell at people in our neighborhood if they tried to stop low-income housing from coming in. Like, anyway.
Not exactly an ideal target of Trump's suburban woman fear-mongering.
Exactly. But she was also very aware that like, you know, being against low-income housing, it was a very mainstream, you know, nice Democrat, you know, have a copy of Roots on your bookshelf position.
Yep. Yeah. It still is.
Yeah. And I feel like she was very like, these are all, you know, hypocrites and screw them. And like, you know, they don't actually want to live next to anybody different from them. They just want to feel good about themselves.
Well, yeah, we're going to like wind our way to, you know, the kind of Trump message about suburban women right now, which is sort of the way that we're occasioning this episode, which is really just about talking to somebody that we both really like. But I wanted to ask, I was sort of reminded of this or triggered to ask this from your discussion of sort of the day-to-day work of grassroots politics, making brownies, finding space, doing that kind of stuff. The one of the things that I know that has been a focus of yours is really on how post-2016 Democratic politics, a big story is liberal women, what they have done. And in your appeal to Warren Mom's piece, which we'll talk about more of the substance of that too, you talk about how like in the wake of 2016 you were suddenly on these text chains with other people. You know, there are people getting involved in these Facebook groups and stuff. And we talked a little bit about this stuff with Rebecca Traister when she was on, who wrote the book Good and Mad, which is sort of its thesis is similar to that idea. But I'd be interested to hear a little bit, because on the left, and it's certainly the Bernie adjacent, and even sometimes in this podcast, I think the quote unquote resistance is treated as a punchline or allied with sort of like neoliberal forces in the Democratic Party or whatever. But I think it'd be helpful for our listeners to like root us back in those days after 2016. What kind of work did you start doing? What did you start seeing? And what sort of changed?
And what do people miss about this? You know, as Sam kind of referenced the discourse, it's like, well, they just, you know, started wearing pussy hats and...
There's a sneering at that stuff, which...
There's a sneering at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all really true. I think one kind of woman that we as a culture don't know how to talk about is someone who participates within institutions, but does not conceive herself of being, nor is not necessarily aligned with the interests of what you'd call the establishment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like a lot of the most annoying fights on the internet are couched in like establishment or anti-establishment yeah. terms, mm-hmm. right? So it's like you're either, you know, trying to create a specific emotional response in like the head of one particular liberal mm-hmm. think tank, mm-hmm. right? Like all your politics is directed around like, are we going to make her smile yeah. or cry, right? And that is about the idea of like, are we going to bring down the establishment? You know, if we take down the establishment, then we'll have this feeling of triumph, and all of these people who make, you know, gargantuan salaries and, you know, live this life, they'll be gone and we'll be triumphant. But I think for a lot of, you know, suburban women, moms, that they don't perceive of themselves as being either the establishment or anti-establishment. Mm-hmm. That's just not a framework that motivates them. And they don't necessarily love the Democratic Party. You know, they don't necessarily think that everything Democrats have done from the dawn of time is perfect. But they also don't necessarily have a desire to topple or overthrow or displace anybody either. So I think part of the way that the discourse gets so annoying is that if you're not out to destroy the establishment, you must be of the establishment.
Right.
But I just don't think that's true. I think you can be this other thing, which is you really, really don't like Donald Trump. You really don't like the fact that he is a serial sexual assailant. You really don't like the fact that he takes children away from their mothers and puts them in cages. And you are motivated by those very strong feelings to try to do what you can within your small community.
Yeah.
You know, the vehicle of the Democratic Party is there, but, you know, just in my own experience, like there was a text chain that went around after 2016, and it was just sad moms. And some of it was women I knew pretty well in my neighborhood, and some of it was women I did not know super well. But they had gotten my number, and, you know, we were all public school moms within a community. We all had roughly the same age kids. And there was this feeling of like, what are we going to do? But the answer wasn't going to be nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it was going to be, we're going to do something. And so spring of 2016, we turn our attentions to the city council race. Everybody gets really invested in it. We go door to door and we flip a city council seat. And it was a really powerful feeling because it's you know, we live in a small city. It's 100,000 people. We flipped the seat by like 300 votes.
Wow.
And it just felt like, okay, we made, you know, these calls, and we, you know, I had at that time a 1-year-old, and I put her in a backpack carrier. So I would ring people's doorbells and then try to like position them so they saw the baby first. She was very cute. And then once I had, you know, it's like the brownie at the bake sale, right? Like once you yeah. have that, then you're like, hey, so now that you've opened your door and I have a baby, let's talk about the issues facing our community. And that group, you know, has persisted on Facebook and, you know, does postcarding and travels to, you know, what was the Katie Hill district, and travels to Katie Porter's district and does door knocking. And, you know, it's been really active. It's also had its own internal tensions, as like any political group that exists, you know, in the mm-hmm. world since the dawn of time has. You know, there are
yep.
factions, you know, even among the wine moms,
I'm sure. mm-hmm.
and tensions, and we don't all agree on everything. But yeah, I think there's a desire to be a part of something. There is the feeling that we can change this and make this better. And there definitely are certain issues that are really important, I would say, to most of the women in here. Like child separation was one that just, there were a ton of protests, you know, there was a ton of activism just within that community, because I think it was really visceral. I think it felt really real to think about being separated from your child.
Yeah. So one comment that I'm just reminded of about the origins of the quote unquote hashtag resistance that people really forget is that one of the motivations was this fear that the Democrats weren't going to do enough to resist Trump.
Absolutely.
We forget that moment where it was like Schumer was like, can't wait to work with him on infrastructure. And
so was Bernie. So was everybody.
Yeah.
Like that friggin' November through Women's March time was terrifying. Yep. It was the carrier stunt.
Yeah.
It was everybody saying like, well, I guess we're passing a giant. I mean, I was terrified.
Yeah.
I was like, he's going to do, you know, anti-capitalist cosplay. He's going to call up CEOs and say like, okay, I'm going to come yell at you on Tuesday. And they'll be like, okay, cool. Come yell at me on Tuesday. Like,
yes, Mr. Trump.
Like, I was expecting like a wave of these sort of performative, hollow, but powerful sort of pushing back at big industry and pushing back at the man and fighting for the little guy. I was expecting Democrats to do nothing. You know, and just like sign off on giant bills. And I have to say, I feel like part of the reason we forget that story is that the Women's March is not foregrounded as a crucial event in this time period.
Yeah.
But I think it really was. It was this enormous sort of statement to everybody, but Democrats in particular, that like, we aren't into this. We don't like him. We will never like him.
Yeah.
So we have your back if you say no.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many things that I love about you, Dorothy, and it's very well articulated in your appeal to Warren Mom's piece that you wrote for Mad at Common Wheel, which was occasioned by Warren dropping out of the primary. And it's basically you're making your case simultaneously to Warren voters, especially Mom Warren voters of the sort that you're kind of sounds like the sort of people who were involved with this organizing after 2016, to say Bernie is the candidate who backs these policies, even if you don't like certain things about his affect, his the way that he, you know, just kind of that question of like tear it all down versus work within the institutions. And at the same time, you're making a plea to the Bernie crowd, in particular, sort of the Bernie campaign. Here's how you could actually reach these people that you absolutely have to reach. And as you know very well, I was very much on the same side of like the Bernie campaign actually has to do something to reach quote unquote, you know, resistance moms. And I think one of the lines that we both like, a sort of first principle for both of us, is that electoral politics is cringe.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, trying to bridge that gap between the Bernie crowd and the Warren voters and the way that you do it in that piece is so good. And one of the reasons that it's so necessary, this is the thing I was forgetting, is that Matt and I have talked about, we talked about this with Sam Moyn when he was on the podcast, the fact that in the wake of 2016, there was a thing that happened where quote unquote resistance was set up as in opposition to whatever Bernie's message was about Trump. This idea that like Bernie was saying, we need to deal with the economic conditions that created the possibility for Trump. And that's one approach. And then there was this other one, which was like focused very much on Trump and his misogyny and his blatant narcissism and just sort of like his sickness as a person and the policies he was trying to implement. And because it kind of was this like, so this sublimation of 2016 debates about what created Trump, it created this sort of this opposition between the quote unquote resistance and the Bernie crowd, which I think persisted into the 2020 primary.
Yeah, the 2020 primary broke my heart into pieces. I mean, I think part of it for me comes from like, I have a lot of friends on the, you know, Team Bernie, you know, capital L left. A lot of them also, you know, present company included, a lot of them also came to that position never having passed through Democrat, right? Like some people are like, I was a Democrat and then I got frustrated and now I'm more of a radical. But a lot of my friends on that side, like, were conservative and then sort of made the jump to being socialist without ever going through like a normie Dem phase.
Matt.
Yeah. Matt. But not only Matt. Like,
I cop to that. I cop to that.
Like a lot of people, like it's a pretty easy journey, right? Because like you can, you know, I get how it happens. So I feel like I have a bunch of friends who are in that camp. And then I also have a bunch of friends who are like, you know, love Nancy Pelosi clapping. And like in a genuine way, like in a genuine way that speaks to them. So I feel like I just I live between these two worlds. I move between these two communities. I have a lot of love in my heart for everybody. And it sort of broke me to watch people prioritize. This is what I get, like, prioritize a certain kind of winning over winning, period.
Yeah.
Like the most sort of painful and short-sighted thing to me about the 2020 primary is I think that there were people who wanted Bernie to win in a kind of a way, and that ultimately the kind of a way started superseding the goal of winning.
Yeah.
And so there was like people were sort of had this vision of like, oh, like I'm going to picture this, like, you know, wine mom, resistance lib, like just crying in the voting booth and
crushed,
like having to pull the lever for Bernie and like, she's going to be so sad and like,
bend the knee,
so awesome.
Say.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was sort of a vision of this like abject, humiliated, middle-aged woman, just in despair. And I think there was
such a good point, Dorothy.
And I think there are ways in which the campaign was run, you know, not necessarily by Bernie, but by people on his team to maximize that end, right? So it was like, how do we make choices so that archetypal middle-aged woman is like maximally unhappy on, you know, election day? And you can do that. Like you can make choices that really foreground her despair. But at the end of the day, you could also have made choices that have her like in an okay mood.
Yeah.
You know, still pulling the lever for Bernie. Like she could even have been joyful pulling the lever for Bernie.
Yeah.
And I just feel like winning with emotion is not better. I mean, losing with strong emotions is not better than winning. Like winning is better.
Yeah. Well, it goes both ways.
Totally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the sense that because of there's a sort of this dialectic that was created between the two of them, whoever started it, which was a thing that people actually cared about ridiculously.
Yeah.
But then Warren became much less of her prairie populist kind
totally.
Of expansive.
Warren fucked up all over the place. Like Warren ran a bad campaign.
She also leaned further into, I'm going to give the emotional satisfaction to exactly that faction of despairing upper middle class professional woman crowd.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give them what they need as Bernie's trying to give the opposite. And
absolutely.
It made them both their campaigns worse.
No, absolutely. I think Warren ran a bad campaign. I think it absolutely started centering around an emotional valence as opposed to being broadly acceptable. And like, yes, at some point, one voter can only purchase so many t-shirts, right? So like one voter, like one Bernie voter wearing five Bernie t-shirts and one Warren voter wearing five Warren t-shirts only get one vote each. Like, no, yeah. I absolutely think that she ran a bad campaign. I think she made a bunch of really terrible choices. I think they got worse as the campaign went on. And I think that ultimately, it stopped being about being broadly acceptable and fine. And if you're trying to get a majority, you know, at some point, like you've got your hardcore fans, you have to step down and be fine. And the whole thing broke my heart.
Yeah.
It broke my heart. It made me really sad.
Not me. I loved it. I loved every moment. I don't know if you saw, you follow me on Twitter. I had a good time during the primary.
It's true. I mean, it was also the first election. I think that my husband and I have voted for different people in the primary, and I voted for Bernie and he voted for Warren, and we just like, you know, put our votes in. But he hadn't been paying attention to any of this because he doesn't live online. And so he was just like, I like Warren. She seems to have good policies, you know, check. And I was just like, you know, anyway, it was, but I also was just like, she doesn't have a chance. We have to move on to plan B. Plan B has to be Bernie.
Well, you know, maybe you could say, Dorothy, that when you run a scorched earth campaign, sometimes you just burn out. But you used the phrase broadly acceptable a couple times in the past few moments. And I think, you know, it's when we have these discussions about gender and politics, you know, I think there's been a lot of rightful focus on kind of Trump's misogyny and, you know, the moments in the debates during 2016 when he seemed to kind of lurch and kind of loom over Hillary. Obviously, the rhetorical tropes he uses, all that's in play. But I think one of the things that I find interesting about you as a political thinker is your attentiveness to how women can actually wield power and the challenges that that causes. And I think there's, you know, a lot that, you know, we mentioned our previous conversation with Rebecca Traister. There's a lot you two would agree upon and a lot that all of us agree upon, both coming from Trump and the challenges women face. But one of the things I find fascinating about you is the way you'll say, you know, Elizabeth Warren should have said, now this isn't very politically correct, but X, right? Even if it is really not that politically incorrect, that sometimes you have to make concessions, you have to make the brownies, you have to knock on that door with the baby in the stroller so that the person who opens the door sees it, to kind of start that conversation. And if we could roll back the tape and you could give Elizabeth Warren advice, or if you don't want to be that specific, just women newly running for office in general, what are the kinds of tensions or trade-offs you see in that, especially if they want to be successful at it?
Yeah, well, I think I'll give an example of someone I think who's doing it really well. Is I think Katie Porter really performs who she is. Like, what you have to do as a politician is perform authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an inherent contradiction.
Yeah.
So you're displaying something at the same time as what you're saying is, you know, this display is real. And there's a way that Trump does it that is really compelling, where he highlights how he's inauthentic and it makes him seem authentic. Mm-hmm. To me, it reminds me of like women who are really upfront about their breast implants.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like there's like a thing mm-hmm. where you like try to act like they're your real breasts and you're sort of shy about it. And then there's people who will just sit down and be like, I paid $20,000 for them and I got them from this doctor and he's amazing. Go ahead, feel.
That's exactly what Trump is. That's exactly right.
And it's crazy, but it also makes you feel like that person is being upfront with you because they're showing you the artifice right away.
And then you're allowed to just enjoy the breasts, enjoy the artifice.
Exactly. And you're like, well, they're not hung up on them. Like, cool.
Yeah.
These are your fake boobs. So I feel like that's one way to do it, which is a sort of Trumpian, like call attention to the artifice and make it a mutual joke.
Yeah.
You know, make it a shared hilarity that anyone would ever be sincere.
Right.
You know, that's one thing. But I think if you have other things, you have to perform your authenticity. I think Bernie is very good at performing his authenticity. I think he is an authentic person. I also think he has a crafted persona.
He has a shtick.
And that's fine.
Yeah. He could comb his hair.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a choice, you know? And uh-huh.
that's great. He hasn't lived in Brooklyn in like 60 years, and he still has that accent.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm. that, you know, they're public figures. They're putting on a persona. And I think for women specifically, it is really challenging because I think there are a lot of stereotypes, and I think there are a lot of like deep cultural fears around women lying that go back to like, I mean, I'm not going to get all like, you know, Evo bio on you, but like, I do think there are sort of incredibly deep lizard brain fears around paternity that make people scared that women aren't telling the truth.
Wow. Yeah.
Because like the ultimate thing a woman could not tell the truth about is who the dad of her baby is.
Yeah.
And she would know that. And you, the husband, just kind of have to trust her, and she might be lying to you. And that's a huge thing to lie about. So I think there's this like incredibly deep lizard brain phobia of women lying that then intersects with the fact that all politics is a performance and a performance of an identity. And it becomes really challenging for women to perform something without seeming false. Mm-hmm. And then I think an additional challenge is that, you know, they've done all these studies and two candidates with the same platform, a candidate who is either a woman or a person of color, is perceived as being more liberal, all things being equal. Huh. So women are perceived just from the jump as being more liberal, which then, if you're trying to win in a general election, if you're trying to sort of win as a centrist, you have to amass a more conservative record. But then if you have to defend a conservative record in a primary, like you could be attacked from the left. It's just, it's complicated.
Or you're lying to get to your point.
And you're, right, exactly. And you're lying. And I feel like the sort of maneuvers of politics are more difficult for women to pull off. I think the bar is higher. I think someday we'll see a really successful woman do this. My guess is she'll be a Republican, but we'll see a woman sort of navigate these things very deftly, and we'll go, oh, that's how you do it, right? Like, it was unimaginable until we saw you do it. And then we go, oh, that's the way you do it, is you do it like her. But I think it's really challenging. And I think my advice, if I was giving advice, because I think that was your question, you know, way back when there was a question, would be to try to lean on tropes and try to perform your authenticity in a way that feels like you're not afraid. And that gets to the sort of, I'm not going to be politically correct. Like, you know, the idea that you are not bound by, you know, a certain code of language, that you're willing to sort of tell it like it is. I think that's really powerful. You know, I think a lot about Jane Sanders, you know, when Bernie started the 2020 campaign, you know, she sort of did this move of like, I know some people aren't going to like it, but I'm not ashamed to say that I'm proud to be Bernie's wife. And it was a sort of jujitsu of positioning against a sort of mean feminist who says you can't like being someone's wife. And I think it's really, I think that's really smart. Like, I think that was a deft rhetorical move to sort of say, like, somewhere out there is a mean feminist who says you can't say these things, but I'm a woman and I'm not going to be cowed by that mean feminist. I'm going to say what I mean from the heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the way I come to this is because I am a screenwriter. I write a lot of stories that have women protagonists, and I get network and studio notes from executives, often who are men, who will tell me what they don't like about my women characters. So I have 10 years. I have 10 years of getting feedback of men basically saying, like, we don't like it when women do X.
Right.
And it's part of why I feel like I watch women politicians, you know, and I'll go like, shut up, stop it. You know, because I'm thinking like, I've gotten this note before and it's not fair. It's not just like, if you're appealing to a court of, you know, neutral arbitration, you would have a very good case, but you're not. You're trying to win an election in a world that's full of people whose worldview is shaped by misogynist forces.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think individual politicians can't necessarily change things as, you know, change everybody's hearts and minds as much as they can maneuver within them, and try to maneuver within, you know, who people are, and people are imperfect and people are shaped by, you know, living under a patriarchal misogynist culture. And I'll watch women do things and I'll be like, the studio executive in my head is saying I don't like her, you know, and I carry him around with me, you know, I carry that little studio executive in my head.
Yeah. I mean, people can be shaped by a misogynist, patriarchal, hyper-capitalist, hyper-individualist culture, and they will one day be shaped by, you know, a eco-socialist feminist political culture, but we have to win that world from this one.
Yep.
We're in this one now. And that's one of the big misapprehensions that people on the sort of more moralist left have.
Yeah. Well, speaking of winning that world, Dorothy, you know, part of the, we've sort of covered some of the Dorothy Fortenberry origin story. But I think one of the things that I notice about you, and this is where you mentioned somewhat, it was a bit of a dig to mention I was a convert from the right. I'm teasing you.
He's incredibly sensitive.
Sam knows that better than anyone. it is not something that registered with me so seismically at the time, which was Bush v. Gore. And I've noticed lately, you, given the state of the Republican Party and given that they're more than leaning into their anti-democratic minority rule strategy, you've gone back to Bush v. Gore a lot, and that was something that was a wake-up call for you. And maybe as a way toward pivoting more towards talking about Trump directly, or at least, you know, the lay of the land right now politically, I wondered if you could talk about that some.
As a way of talking about now, can you talk about something that happened 20 years ago?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, so 20 years ago, I was 20, and that was the first presidential election I voted in. And I remember being, I'm just going to talk a lot and you can edit this later. I remember being like a little baby pundit, and Madonna came out with an album that summer. And in the video, she wore this gold cowboy hat. And I saw the video and I was like, Bush is going to win. I was like, the fact that Madonna has decided that like the national mood wants someone in a gold cowboy hat is like a cultural signifier.
Damn. Slate
where
pitch.
A moment
slate
is at.
Pitch.
Slate pitch, mm-hmm. Maureen Dowd column. Yeah. I mean, what was I doing? But I remember like, you know, being at an election results party and sort of the moment that I got called and then uncalled. And then I was taking an American 20th century political history class the next day. And I went and my professor asked for show of hands of who had voted. And like, I don't know, a third of the class had.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're highly educated, you know, very fancy people. We're taking an American 20th century political history class. And, you know, only a third of the people had voted. And it felt like such a sign of how low stakes people perceived the 2000 election to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dorothy, I should just say we're exactly the same age. And the night of the Bush v. Gore contest, that election night, when it was clear that the result was going to be sometime coming, I was standing around in a circle around a flagpole, holding hands, praying for George W. Bush's victory.
You did it.
I know. God answered my prayers.
God answered your prayers.
Good job, Matt.
Yeah. So I apologize for my contribution to that. But I was, just to give listeners a sense of where I was at, I did want to throw that in there.
Yeah. I was in Massachusetts at a party that was all Gore voters except for one swing state Nader voter who slowly turned on as the night went. Like he went from being sort of like a curiosity, like, oh, isn't that funny? But, and like, as the evening wore on, like the room shifted.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. And I think I remember that decision. The thing I think about Bush v. Gore is it could have been an opportunity for liberals to look at the court with new eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't. It just wasn't. And I think a lot of that is 9/11. Like, I think a lot of that is, you know, who Bush would have had to be. You know, he scooted in with such an asterisk and in such a sort of ass backwards way. But culturally and sort of emotionally, the nation was ready for him because the idea was that there wasn't that much difference.
Right.
Destiny's Child performed at his inauguration. Like he was broadly seen as this acceptable, fine person. In a world with no 9/11, like maybe he would have had to try to sort of earn something that he didn't quite get. But because 9/11 happened, all of a sudden the valence of everything shifts. And all of a sudden, if you say anything critical about the United States or the president, you're, you know, a terrorist and you're anti-American and, you know, all of a sudden Democrats were sort of tripping over each other to have the largest flag pin and the whole thing kind of stopped. And so I feel like liberals and Democrats never really took Bush v. Gore for what it was, which is a sign that the court is absurd and corrupt and doesn't have to be listened to.
Right.
And instead it just became like this weird oopsie daisy. You know, it's just a mammoth, it's a mammoth failure on the part of Democrats. It's a mammoth failure on the part of sort of intra-group storytelling. I feel like if you look at the way that the right talks about Bork, like that story is kept alive. That is told at the campfire and you can recite it chapter and verse.
Gather around, children, gather around.
You don't even have to tell the story. You just say Bork.
Bork is like, Bork, working. We've made it a verb. Like it's so embedded. And Bush v. Gore should have and could have, and with, you know, a competent, narratively gifted Democratic Party, would have been the story of like the time that the court did this thing. And it just isn't. And it sort of became this weird historical footnote. And I feel like we're, you know, I hope not gearing up for another round of it. But it's very telling to me that the court and the identity of the court is so important to the right, and that they feel like it's this way to safeguard against things. And that by and large, you know, Democrats and liberals, you know, can make memes of individual justices, but like don't have any sense of what the court actually has done. It's just a huge failure. It's just like a mammoth failure of the Democratic Party and the left in general.
Yeah, I recently watched one of those PBS Frontline documentaries about Bush v. Gore, because it's obviously kind of on the mind. And I was struck by, you know, right away, within hours the next morning, James Baker was on a flight to Florida. Mm-hmm. James Baker, who, whatever else you think of him, is like a real knife fighter, right? He knows how to get shit done. And then the Democrats, their reply was to tap Warren Christopher, the kind of, you know, elderly former, I guess, also Secretary of State. I don't know if they thought they needed one too. But there was this lunch described where James Baker sits down across from Warren Christopher and basically says, here's how it's going to work. We win, you lose. You can even see kind of the pathologies of the Democratic Party at work in that moment based on kind of who they chose to lead the effort. And then even Gore was, I mean, it's explicit. He explicitly told aides who then were interviewed for this documentary that the key thing was not to disturb the institution.
Yeah.
Right? To not discredit the court, to not endanger the system in some way. And it was just really a kind of deja vu.
And like, the thing is, like, as sort of an institutionalist, like, there is a part of me that mm-hmm. respects and understands what that is if that's a mutually shared obligation. You know, if everybody mm-hmm. gets together and says, look, at the end of the day, the institutions of America are worth preserving. And if we have to take the L, we'll do it, because what we want to do is not devolve into civil war. We don't want, you know, everything to become meaningless. I can respect in some ways the desire to, you know, uphold the institutions over the individuals, but it's just not true. Mm-hmm. It's completely asymmetric and
yes.
accelerating. And you just look like a chump. Like, it goes yeah. back to being a chump, right? Uh-huh. Like, I feel like at this point, the sort of thing that I obsess about is the only way that institutions function is if everyone kind of agrees to go along with them. Mm-hmm. And if only some people are going along with them, then those people are necessarily chumps. Those people are yes. stupid. You know, if some people can ride the train for free and you're paying to ride the train, like, you're a moron. just don't pay for a train ticket. Like, what are you doing? When you watch, you know, Republican senators not even really have to defend, you know, their switching of positions on, you know, do we seat Supreme Court justices in election years or no? You know, the answer is, like, we do what we want. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't love it. I don't feel like it's a great, great way for people to be.
Yeah.
And I don't, I'm not excited about what this current court is going to get up to.
Well, because you're bringing it up, and because we've also talked about sort of the way that women political figures present themselves, especially in relation to, say, their children, and the political consequences, good and bad, of presenting themselves explicitly as mothers, I think we would be remiss if we did not talk a little bit about the notorious ACB. I imagine that you have some thoughts about the way, you know, not just the structural political fight over her nomination, but the way that Republicans have presented Amy Coney Barrett to the American people, and the ways that Democrats have tried to counter that to the extent that they have done literally anything at all. I can hear you're loving this question.
Yeah.
Our conversation has led us to this point, and we have no choice but to talk about it.
The thing that's so crazy to me about the way that Republicans have positioned her is they're basically saying, like, she has kids. Why would she believe the things that she's on record saying that she believes?
Yeah. Those things being like,
like, I think the ACA is a bad decision and, you know, people shouldn't have Obamacare. Like, she has said it in like as part of her job in print, and the just disingenuousness of, like, how could a mother ever take healthcare away? I'm like, I don't know. But, like,
but they do.
The reason that they think that she's going to do it, right, the reason they think she's going to do it is because she said she's going to do it. Like, it's on her to prove that she's not. And acting like, because somebody's a mother. I mean, I feel like she, this thing I was talking about how, you know, women who are, have the same positions because they're women get this sort of liberal, you know, plus five lib points. Like, I think it hurts women politicians on the left. But I think it helps women politicians on the right, because the idea is, like, she couldn't possibly.
Right.
Like, you know, she's obviously a kind and mm-hmm. warm-hearted person. She couldn't possibly believe the things that she said. I think people respond to that. I mean, I think if you look at the polling now, like, some large chunk of Democrats are pumped for her to be on the court. because she was successful in the hearings, and because I think what they heard about her was that she's a mom, and so they put what they presume are mom values onto her. They are doing the thing that, you know, I've been talking about, right? Which is like, how do you make a compelling female protagonist? Mm-hmm. How do you make somebody that network executive is going to like? And I think she's doing a better job of it than, you know, a lot of Democratic women, which is depressing to me because I despair of her agenda, but I feel like she's maneuvering herself successfully. The other thing about her is I do feel like this question of like sincerity and belief also get wrapped up in, because she says things and then people say, you know, how dare you think she would do that? How could you possibly say she would do that when, you know, it's out in the open? And I feel like it's making a moron of somebody, right? Like either she does what she said she's going to do and she does strike down, you know, Obamacare and we don't have Obamacare anymore, or she doesn't and she upholds it because it would be politically dicey, but then all of her previous positions were in bad faith. You know, she can't do both.
Yeah.
And I feel like what it does is it makes the electorate cynical. It makes all of us just sort of like, it makes us all slightly shittier people.
Yeah.
To see how shallow people's commitments are. Like, I don't want somebody who is, you know, a strong right-wing ideologue on the court, but I'd rather have someone who is a strong right-wing ideologue and meant what they said than somebody who coasts to where they are on one set of beliefs and then when in power enacts another one for fear of blowback. Like, that feels worse. That feels slimier.
Yeah. I think one thing that's interesting to me, and this kind of like, it reminds me a little bit of the tension in your Dworkin essay and the sort of thing we talked about earlier about the rebel and the rule follower. But there's also something so interesting about the way that she gets to simultaneously be presented as the hero of the sort of Catholic mom narrative because she has so many children, and the hero of the professional woman narrative because she's so successful. You know, like the Republicans love saying like, this person is just so brilliant. She's such a brilliant woman. You know, she's look, her notepad doesn't have any notes on it. And at the same time, they want to present her as the hero of the story of Catholic womanhood, which is that she's a mother who raised a bunch of children. And if we take, you know, some of the implication from her involvement with the People of Praise, is that, you know, also very submissive to her husband and to the leaders of that organization. So she gets to do both in the Republican messaging. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think what she's able to do is communicate that if there is any reason why you haven't been able to do these things, it's, you know, your lack of trying hard. I think it becomes this very individualistic message of, you know, if she can do this, if she can have seven kids and, you know, be so powerful in her career, you know, then you surely could if you just, you know, multitask better. And there aren't any systems holding you back. Yeah. There's just, you know, your own lack of trying hard and your own lack of commitment. I don't know. I feel like the thing about her that I am so just like, I have such a hard time with is the degree to which she continually goes on the side of economic power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if you're Catholic, like, it's not surprising that somebody is anti-abortion. It's not surprising that somebody is pro-life. Like, mm-hmm. that is a position that you encounter frequently, right? Like, you know, it comes with the church. It's not shocking territory. It certainly doesn't mean that every Catholic politician is going to be, you know, a pro-life politician, but it's not a shocker. Mm-hmm. It's church doctrine. It comes with the book. You know, you get the pamphlet. It's in the pamphlet. But the degree to which she upholds corporations over workers and her like climate non-answer.
Yeah,
I know.
Are the parts where I like, as a Catholic mom, like where I go like, wait a minute, like the whole point of religious faith, I think, or a whole point of religious faith should be that it gives you the courage of your convictions to stick up for stuff when it's hard and to say, I understand that the larger cultural forces around me and the larger economic...
Or even the Republicans that put me in this position to be at this hearing.
Or even the Republicans that put me in this... Absolutely. Anybody. Everybody wants me to do one thing, but I have the courage of my convictions. I have an inner strength. I'm going to swim the wrong way up the stream because at the end of the day, I'm going to be judged on my choices. And like, they're going to look at this and they're going to assess whether or not, you know, I made the right choice. And I was shocked. You know, I was really genuinely shocked. And then I felt like a chump for being shocked.
Yeah.
You know, I was absolutely appalled. And I was like, but you can't do that. Like climate is not actually a controversial issue within the church. It's an incredibly clear issue. Like, it's not just Francis. You know, it goes back decades. Like, ecological care and concern and climate change in particular have been, they're just not controversial. Uh-huh. Like, they're very basic things that the church is incredibly clear and open mm-hmm. on. And to act like there's some kind of, you know, secret and like we can't know and it's all a mystery is going against church teaching. And it's going against church teaching in this way that, because you know that when you get on the court, you want to signal to the Koch brothers that you've got their back and they can put all the carbon they want in the atmosphere. Like, I was really shocked. I was heartbroken, you know, and I hadn't realized I'd been holding out hope for her.
Yeah.
You know, and I had that some part of me had been like, okay, like we're not going to agree on everything, but maybe she will be this, you know, pro-social, you know, I keep waiting for the populist right? Like, I'm like, maybe Amy Coney Barrett will be the force of, you know, we can go after corporations. We just don't like abortions. And no, that person, it's not her. She's got the corporation's backs.
And it was so telling too, because I actually thought this was a line of questioning that Kamala Harris did really well at, where she said, do cigarettes cause cancer? Mm-hmm. And Barrett says, yes. Is the coronavirus transmissible via air? Yes. Is climate change real? Well, you know, that's where the hedge came. And I thought it was obviously a nod to her dear leader, Donald Trump, and the Koch brothers, and just, you know, all the forces on the right that oppose even acknowledging that climate change is real. And I think furthermore, it was, you know, maybe if you wanted to be super generous, you could grant her that one issue. But then she refused to even state outright that the president should allow a peaceful transfer of power should he lose,
oh,
right? Or not even should he lose, but just in general, should presidents concede to a peaceful transfer of power? And I thought that was where, you know, any doubt you might have had about what her climate change answer meant, it was very clear why she was ducking certain questions. And I just thought that was, again, Dorothy, as you're saying, I would respect at a certain level a sort of seamless garment Catholic. Right, you could at least admire the consistency and the kind of consistency with which she would kind of uphold, you know, the basic tenets of what she claims to believe, or at least acknowledge them in some way. But she didn't.
Yeah.
And I would say, furthermore, you know, raising all these kids, I highly suspect that one reason she was able to do that is because she lives in a religious community, meaning the people of praise. But that was something we weren't allowed to talk about because Dianne Feinstein made a nasty comment in 2017. So, you know, any kind of questions even related to that were totally off limits. And I found the whole experience quite frustrating. And I got my frustrations out in one article, but then have mostly shut up about it.
I think it's interesting, you know, as the non-Catholic here, I think you guys have really nailed something, which is that, like, Catholics in political life are rewarded for doing things that go against modern life. They go against the sort of like pressures of the individualist liberal culture that says women are supposed to want to be professionals and not raise a big family. And that's like an act of heroism. This is something we talked about. I was recently revisiting our episode with Will Arbery about Heroes of the Fourth Turning, because he's been doing, they've been doing that show online recently. And that's something that Catholic political figures are rewarded for doing. They are willing to do something that brings the opprobrium of the political culture, of the popular culture. And in the case of Amy Coney Barrett, being a mom to seven children is like, you know, politically incorrect in some way for a professional woman, right? And she does it, and everyone goes, and the Catholic right goes, absolutely, that's why we love her. But what you're saying is so correct. It's like, well, you know, in a certain way, in the position that she's put in is one in which it does not reward her politically, for getting this job, to say, you know what, climate change is real, and I care about the future for my children, and my church tells me that it's real, and it's a great moral and political problem of our time, and I'm not gonna compromise on it just because like it would serve me in the next 5 minutes to do so. But nobody seems to give a shit. Nobody cares that she's not going to be a hero in that moment. They only care when she's going to be a hero in a way that comports perfectly well with like mainstream Republican policy. So where's the heroism?
Yeah.
As Judith Butler said in her Jewish Currents takedown of Barry Weiss, more courage, Amy Coney Barrett.
I mean, I agree. I feel very similarly, you know, this is incredible. You know, at least I have core beliefs, right? Like I live in Hollywood. Okay. And I, you know, I'm on a coast and I got married in my milieu is very young. I got married at 25. You know, I had my first kid. I got pregnant at 30. Those aren't shocking numbers nationally. And I don't know what sort of, you know, Catholic averages are, but for my universe, those are really weird. And I have had like many choices at which like I had a professional opportunity and I turned it down because, you know, I was going to go be with my husband, or I had a professional something and I was like, nope, I'm going to do this thing for my kids. And whatever, I'm not saying this to be like, I'm so awesome, but I'm saying like, I thought the deal was you have a faith and then it gives you the strength to stand against, you know, individualistic, capitalistic forces that only want you to be successful and make a lot of money. And the joy of having the faith was you got to go like, no, I think something else matters. Something else matters more. I'm going to take this risk and do this thing that's less safe because I believe in it. And, you know, here I go doing this thing. And yeah, it makes me feel like a chump, you know, to watch her say climate change isn't real. And it makes me just incredibly, incredibly angry.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, it's simply the case that simply acknowledging that climate change is real does not wed her to any judicial decision.
No, it's so cowardly.
In other words, it would have been totally appropriate for her to acknowledge its reality. That would not have been some breach of judicial, just as it was not a breach for her, of her judicial even-handedness to say that cigarettes cause cancer. It would not have been a breach for her to acknowledge climate change. And so I just want to kind of emphasize that we're not talking about her weighing in on particular cases or possible cases. We're simply asking or suggesting she might have acknowledged a basic reality that should not be controversial.
I mean, even if the church was ahead of the scientific consensus.
I mean, but like...
she probably should have said. Or certainly the political consensus.
I mean, it is. And I feel like that one of the things that I really get out of being Catholic is that it doesn't line up super neatly with, you know, Democrat, Republican politics. You know, it's not a pure overlap onto either. It has incredibly, you know, critical things to say about both. And for me, it's really useful to have a community that I'm a part of that doesn't, you know, map precisely onto other communities that I'm a part of. I like straddling communities. I like being a part of multiple groups, understanding what their worldview is, and then going into a different group and being like, oh, okay, and this is how you see the world. Oh, okay, and this is how you see the world. Like that's, yeah. I feel like that makes me, you know, more thoughtful and more willing to criticize myself and more willing to sort of see the errors and the holes and the flaws in the worldviews that surround me. But it only works if you're capable of being brave and of listening.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, I have the same experience, Dorothy, being an editor at a Catholic magazine. You do just encounter people with different views. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Common Wheels. We're not just a more liberal or progressive publication, but we're a Catholic one. And I think sometimes those, you know, that exerts a certain useful cross-cutting pressure on me as a thinker and writer. And of course, you know, in this election season where, you know, talking about the Catholic vote, Joe Biden is famously Catholic. I actually think because he's a person of faith, the kind of grief the country's feeling over the pandemic, I think he's able to channel it, you know, in part because of his own the grief in his own life and the tragedies in his own life. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Catholic vote, and I'm not even sure it makes sense to talk of that because it seems like, you know, it's pretty evenly split. And we don't even really know for sure whether Hillary or Trump won the Catholic vote. It was very close. But I thought maybe we could close out by talking about not the Catholic vote, but maybe another important demographic and constituency, which is women voters, and especially white women of the suburban kind that we've been describing, and their really visceral reaction against Trump. And it seems like if Biden does win, they'll have been an important factor in that win. And I wondered if you could just talk about that some. I mean, we've covered some of this ground already, but in this moment right now, I wonder what you're thinking or what you're seeing or what you're hearing.
And maybe why isn't Trump tweeting all the time about suburban housewives, listen up. If Biden wins, it's all over for the suburbs. Like,
yeah.
If that's not working, why isn't it working?
Yeah, we've thought about titling this episode Suburban Woman.
That's awesome.
So you're our focus group, Dorothy. Please explain to us all that women are thinking right now.
I love it. I love being a suburban woman. I love being a focus group. I mean, I think, you know, even just looking on my block, I feel like you can sort of see the reasons that is not a perfect appeal, which is that, like, my, you know, my next door neighbors, my behind the house neighbors, my neighbors across the street, the people next to them, I'm the only person who's a white person married to a white person.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're the suburbs.
Misapprehension there. Yeah.
And there are a lot of interracial couples, you know, but it's not uniform. And so the idea that you could just sort of purely boogeyman around race, I think, is based in an idea of what the suburbs are that's out of date. Like, you know, it's also not a purely Democratic block, right? Like, there are people with Blue Lives Matter bumper stickers, you know, three houses down from that. Like, this, my suburb is definitely has people who are conservative, definitely has people who, you know, are very into supporting cops in the military. It also has people who have Biden signs. It also has people who are not white, who are into supporting cops. Like, it doesn't map neatly into anybody's sort of, you know, idea. It's a suburb, and we have nice tree-lined streets.
It's kind of like how the, as you mentioned, the ever just around the corner populist right talks about the working class. You would think it's all, you know, white men working on auto assembly lines or automobile assembly lines, but actually it's much more diverse and complicated. And I feel like the way the trope of the working class and the trope of the suburbs, there's real resonances between how the right seems to think about those. And then when that message lands, part of the weirdness of it is, as you're pointing to, the on-the-ground complexity and diversity of these people.
Yeah. So my suburb is, you know, is not, in some ways, like, does it look physically, you know, do the houses look like you look when you picture a suburb? Sure. They're like little bungalows and there's trees and, you know, there's a bike path and, you know, it's phenotypically suburban in that way, but it's also not. We're also, you know, a mix of people from all over. And I don't think we're able to be swayed by necessarily like monolithic concerns. I also think I've been thinking a lot about like sort of pop culture around women and politics. And there's this album that came out, I think last year, maybe 2 years ago, The High Women.
Oh, I love that record.
Such a good album. And I feel like it's sort of the best articulation of a certain like middle age political female outlook, but that's not, it is not, it doesn't map neatly onto the things that we think about, right? Like, I couldn't tell you who that album voted for in the primary, you know, and there are certain political things that don't penetrate anywhere, but the concerns, you know, broadly around taking care of your kids, being generally open and welcoming to people who are different, and that general open and welcoming extends both in the direction of your friend who's a lesbian, your friend who is an immigrant, but also like your curmudgeonly dad who smokes too much and probably says incorrect things from time to time, that you don't cast that person out. You don't say, you know, like, be gone with you. You said the wrong vocabulary word. We're never speaking again. No, you go and visit him, you know, because he's your dad and you love him. I feel like that album captures more than any document I can think of sort of what it is to be a you know, middle-aged, middle-class woman in this time, trying to do the work of taking care of your kids, trying to do your job, whatever your job is, trying to make things a little bit better, and that you can look in and, you know, for whatever I think about Nancy Pelosi, like, Mr. Make It Worse is a good nickname. Like, he does, in fact, make things worse, right? Like, it's pretty.
And maybe Brandi Carlile could write a good song called Mr. Make It Worse.
Absolutely, right? Like, he makes things worse. And I think that, you know, you can look at that and just see that he's doing it and see that, like, that's why you want him gone, is because he is just making absolutely everything worse.
It's actually a great title for a country song, Mr. Make It Worse.
It really is. And we all know that guy, right? Like, we all know the guy who just, whatever the situation is, he absolutely makes it worse. So I feel like there's that album to me very much speaks to the politics of now. And then I was thinking about the song that I listened to in college, which is this Dar Williams song.
Oh, man. You did hang out with a lot of lesbians in college.
I hung out with a lot of lesbians in college.
You have to know that all the women in my family, in my immediate family, are lesbians. So I'm very familiar with Dar Williams.
So you know the Dar Williams song, the what is it, Pointless Yet Poignant Crisis of a Co-ed?
Yes.
So I think that song is like an incredibly important, like Bush v. Gore document, right?
Yeah.
Because it basically posits that like activism is sort of silly. And like activism is like a little bit embarrassing.
Yes.
It's sort of like your boyfriend telling you not to shave your legs. Like, she gets involved in activism because she's dating this guy and they run the Hemp Liberation League. But by the time she's, but that's sort of the last verse of the song, like, she's older, she gets married, like, she's not in the streets anymore. Like, the idea in the early aughts was that, like, you did this stuff in college, maybe, you know, over like legalizing pot or whatever, but like, by the time you grew up and you had kids, like, that you weren't going to do that anymore. Like, maybe you'd write a letter, but you weren't going to be in the streets. That would be absurd. And I feel like the change in the last 20 years has been that women aren't leaving. They are going into the streets. They are running things. They are running the marches. They are running the campaigns. They are, you know, putting their shoes on and getting out there and doing stuff. And it's not considered to be silly, and it's not considered to be absurd. It's actually vital, and we should all be really grateful to them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm so happy that this episode will be able to have a playlist associated with it, which is all which is what we always want from a good KYE episode. The Highway Women. Matt, have you listened to the Highway Women album?
Not since it came out.
It's a super group based on the Highwaymen. I mean, like, well, not
right.
Based
I got
on,
the
but,
reference.
You know,
yeah, I
got it. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm just trying to put it in terms Matt would understand. Johnny Cash.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Kris Kristofferson were in a band called the Highwaymen. And Brandi Carlile, Natalie Hemby, Maren Morris, and Amanda Shires are in the Highwaymen.
Yes, I get it. And Sam, I'm always looking for ways to just endear your mother more to me and the podcast. So I'm grateful for Dorothy's Dar Williams reference here.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah, Jamie is definitely, hopefully she's listening. All right, she does say that we don't have enough women on the podcast, which is true. So she'll be almost certainly listening to this one.
Yeah.
And she's a huge fan of the Highwaymen and Brandi Carlile in particular. And Handmaid's Tale, for that matter.
Yeah, no, that album is great. And it speaks to, I think, a, you know, substantial community of people and what they're going through right now.
Yeah.
The song, the Highwaymen song, which is like their retake on the Highwaymen song, is really, I find it very moving. It's sort of like different women speaking from different eras of American history as women who didn't go along.
Yeah. I the thing about that song that kills me is, especially when you compare it to the original Highwaymen, is that they're all so embedded in community. It's all about women in relationship to other people. And, you know, if I'm trying to think about, you know, how can women politicians be good storytellers? Like, yeah, okay, it's a trope and maybe it's a stereotype that women care about other people and do care work, but it's also true, and it's also really moving to hear stories about women taking care of other people, taking care of their children, taking care of their community, taking care of their religious groups. Like the highwaymen all go off alone. They go into space or the West or whatever, and they're these solo figures, and the highwaymen are always connected and embedded and grounded with other people. And I just, I mean, I like sob every time I listen to it. And if that's cringe, okay, I'm cringe. You know, fully admit it.
Yeah.
Because I like, you know, I have spent a lot of my life taking care of people. You know, I take care of my kids. Yeah. I take care, you know, of older generations. Like I take care of my community. I am that person. I am that person who picks up trash on the playground and, you know, changes diapers, and that's okay. And there's nothing bad about that.
Yeah. Well, Dorothy, I'm, I should say, I can now reveal, I'm certainly grateful for, you know, your friendship and the care you've shown me. We've been texting buddies really through the primaries for our hot takes that were too hot for Twitter. So I'm grateful for the care and love you've shown me. And I would just say to Sam, you've been very judicious, Dorothy, this episode, but, and you've shown us both, I think, equal amounts of love, but I would just tell Sam that, in this case, I am the only true friend of Dorothy in this conversation.
Fair enough.
Yes. Well, I'd love to end on a note of like, the thing that our politics need is care and community, and it needs probably less of the male heroics of the highwaymen and more of the female heroics of staying in community and building something together. Mm-hmm. It's very in keeping with our consistent themes on the podcast and why we were so excited to have you on.
Yeah, thank you, Dorothy.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.